Hi, everyone. Data from the National Assessment of Educational Progress administered in 2024 revealed substantial drops in reading scores for students spanning primary, middle, and secondary grade levels. Such declines were present prior to the pandemic, but have accelerated since. One specific finding accentuates these challenges. In 2022, only 40% of fourth graders were proficient in reading. In response to these compounding challenges, more than 40 states have passed laws mandating use of evidence-based reading instruction aligned with the science of reading. We'll be discussing this topic in depth in today's Teaching Matters podcast.
Welcome to Teaching Matters, a podcast exploring all things teaching and learning. Teaching Matters is produced by NPR affiliate WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. And here is your host, Dr. Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University.
Thanks so much, Trinity. Today we're joined by Laura Stewart, who is the Chief Academic Officer for the 95% Group. Her organization specializes in creating interventions and assessment based on high-efficacy evidence-based solutions grounded in contemporary science of reading research. Laura, it's great to meet you. Thanks for giving me your time today on the podcast.
Well, it's a delight for me to be here with you, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So I want to start sort of on a broad level with you. I just highlighted those statistics from the nation's report card. We've known that there have been issues with reading scores for a long time. It's not something that's new. We've seen a slow trickle and then some acceleration. Just contextualizing that on a national level, have you given thought to how we might contextualize why reading scores seem to be at a problem state now that maybe wasn't there before? Was it a matter of we didn't know that it wasn't there and it was? Or, you know, what's going on from your perspective?
Yeah, Scott, that's a really great question. And, you know, it's one we've been asking ourselves ever since the most recent scores have come out. And I think that, first of all, we have to kind of level set and say that scores have been flat for quite a long time. And I think the question we're asking ourselves is, why aren't they going up, right? That's, I think, the question we keep asking ourselves. And actually, I published an op-ed in eSchool News on this very question. And so I gave a lot of thought behind it. You know, there's been so much work done in reading, I guess. And so that's why we keep asking ourselves, okay, there's been so much work done. You know, why aren't we seeing a rise in scores? You know, there's been billions of dollars invested and invested in teacher training and curricula. And like you said, the states invested in the science of reading legislation. And we're just not seeing that recovery from pandemic era learning loss, especially. So I would like to say that I think that the answer is complex. And if you look at some of the media reporting, you know, people are pointing blame. You see a lot of different factors that are blamed. You see absenteeism, you see overuse of devices, you know, teacher shortages, student behavior, virtual learning, misuse of funding, on and on and on. And I think that the why is going to continue. We're going to continue to ask ourselves why. But I continue to ask myself, and I know many of my colleagues are asking ourselves, is, you know, is the science of reading failing to deliver on its promise? So I want to offer some perspective on that. You know, many of us, I think, in the field who are really putting our efforts behind the reading research and putting resources into the world, you know, feel like we've been working hard and we're making gains. And like you said, the states with legislation, we're putting those pieces into place. You know, and we've got podcasts like yours and webinars and publications and media reports. And we think that all roads must be leading to the science of reading. But is that really true? You know, we've come a long way. But in our little insulated world that we think is all about the science of reading, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done. You know, there are still institutions of higher education in which teachers are not learning instructional practices aligned with the research. There are still materials that are dominating, you know, the market that are not aligned with the evidence. Yeah, there's legislation, but some of that legislation is vague or it's lacking in accountability. It's not being measured. And there are areas that we're still not paying close attention to. There's leadership and there's community and there's targeted funding. You know, all of these areas really require attention. So I would say, yes, we've come a long way, but there's really implementation issues that we have to pay more attention to. So I believe we have to stay the course. Mm-hmm. We have to attend to success stories. We have to form coalitions. You know, I think about, you know, your most recent guest, Rebecca, you know, from when she was at Louisiana DOA, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think about Louisiana. That's a great, success story around forming coalitions. You know, in Louisiana, the DOE and the Louisiana Literacy Advisory Committee and the Center for Literacy and Learning, forming that coalition, you know, showing that there are places that they're making tremendous growth. We have to follow those kinds of blueprints in order to really show growth in implementation. And at local levels, we have to have honest conversations in school districts about how all of our kids are really doing. Yeah. You know, we have to be courageous leaders. We have to commit to long-term transformative literacy initiatives. Mm-hmm. So I guess my perspective is there's a lot in place, but we still have more work to be done. We have to commit to long-term transformative literacy initiatives. There's more science to explore as well. You know, I mentioned the implementation science. I wrote a book called The Courage to Lead Literacy, and it's really about addressing the implementation science. We have to be relentless in looking at how do we lead through true transformative change. And, you know, how do we look at really putting in place evidence-aligned practices and evidence-based instructional materials? How do we give up what isn't working, no matter how uncomfortable that might be for us as adults? So I guess my perspective is we've come a long way, but there's a lot of work still to be done.
When I think most guests, you know, that are listening to this podcast will have heard the phrase science of teaching before. But, you know, when you have phrases like that in discourse, you sort of don't stop and think about what that actually means. How do you characterize if somebody said, you know, Laura, I hear about science of teaching so much. What actually is that? Is that a philosophy? Is that a perspective? What does it actually mean if we were trying to explain that to, you know, people that maybe haven't dug into the literature?
Yeah, science of reading or science of teaching?
Science of reading. Sorry if I said teaching.
Yeah. Science of reading. Well, you know, when we think about the science of reading, we're really talking about looking at this preponderance of evidence that we have had available to us over the past several decades. And I think that over the past several decades, one thing that we haven't done, probably, is we haven't really looked to our profession as being a profession that can look at scientific evidence. And I know that, for example, when I came up as a teacher, we really didn't see our profession as one in which we could look at a base of scientific evidence. So I believe that, you know, the science of reading is really this preponderance of evidence that has been available to us over the past few decades, high quality evidence that really points to, I guess I would say, practices that are practices that we can adopt that provide efficacy and results for students.
I had trouble thinking yesterday about how to exactly phrase this question because I don't want to phrase it in a way that leads listeners to think that, you know, I'm throwing all the teachers under the bus and asking it in this way. But If you look at the movement to integrate science of teaching resources and materials based upon that into instruction, it implies that we need to move towards something and away from something that is currently being done. Can you sort of characterize what that is in tangible ways so that, you know, listeners can understand this is what we've been doing and we need to move away from that and move towards something else? Are there some tangible, you know, linchpins that you can sort of highlight to illustrate that?
Yeah, I think so. Well, first of all, I guess I can speak from my own experience. Maybe that's a good way to kind of characterize it. So when I came up as a teacher, of course, this was a long time ago, you know, the whole language movement was very popular. And the whole language movement was really based on this appealing idea. It's a very appealing idea that learning to read was as natural as learning to speak. And if we put students in the same conditions as learning to speak, you know, immersion, we immerse them in print, we model what a good reader does, we let them explore books, that reading would happen in the same way that that children learn to speak. And in fact, that something explicit like phonics would simply get in the way, you know, of that natural process. You know, were there studies to support that? No. You know, were there personalities, even academics, espousing this? Yes. You know, did this theory sweep across our country and the English-speaking the world? Yes, absolutely. And that kind of held sway for decades, you know, kind of morphing into balanced literacy. And so, you know, this idea of looking into evidence has been slow to take hold. And there are still, you know, many conversations around, well, is it my science or your science? Or, you know, you can make research say whatever you want. There's still those kinds of conversations happening. So I think, you know, first of all, we have to kind of, the big shift, I guess, is around, again, this idea that there is, you know, there is evidence, there's high quality evidence, a research base, a preponderance of evidence that can really point us, you know, in a direction as an educational profession, as an education profession. Now, I give that example from my own experience, not to characterize this as a black and white, good and bad issue. I just wanted to give an example, you know, of how we operated before we started paying attention, you know, that we have this evidence that we're calling the science of reading. So what I think we really want to do is I think we want to think about, you know, number one, how do we look at data, right? How do we look at data? And unless all of our students are reading well, we have to recognize that what we are doing is not meeting the needs of all our students, right? Number one. Number two, look at that preponderance of evidence and limit our practices to those that are proven to be most effective for all students, right? That's really what this is about. You know, I always say to teachers, you know, how many of you have an extra hour a day that you just don't know what to do with? Nobody has that, right? So we have a limited amount of time with these kiddos, and how do we maximize that time? And so we do have, you know, this kind of driving body of evidence that points to best practices that get the best bang for our buck. So, you know, how do we, you know, look at that and limit our practices to those that are most effective? So that's number two. Adopt those practices, number three, and train all of our educators to deliver that instruction with precision. And I say all educators because I believe that all teachers are reading teachers. And I have spent quite a bit of time recently with teachers of older students, and they are asking, what do I do? What do I do? I've got fourth, fifth, middle school, high school students who are not reading. And you mentioned the scores, the national scores. You know, we do have a lot of students in these middle, upper grades who are not reading. And the lifelong consequences of low literacy or illiteracy, we could do an entire podcast on that. I don't need to go deeply into that, but I think we all know. So all teachers are reading teachers. So adopt those practices and train all educators on how to deliver that instruction with precision. And adopt a system in which we deliver that core instruction to all and use diagnostic instruction to pinpoint additional instruction for tiers 2 and 3 intervention and continue to progress monitor and adjust that instruction as needed. And then I think the fifth thing is to adopt instructional resources which serve those instructional practices. So I think that's what we really have to think about is, you know, is what does that instructional cycle look like, and really have, you know, data drive that instructional cycle and be really, really focused on that and really look, be really discerning consumers around what practices we're using and what resources are we using for those practices. I would say the other shift that is really important is something that your last guest really alluded to, and I really want to make a point because this is really important to me, is we have to shift away from this idea that in the early grades we learn to read, and from fourth grade on up we read to learn. You know, this is really important. We think somehow that once the kids have mastered basics that we're good to go. And, you know, one of the reasons that our kids, you know, are hitting the wall, I believe, in fourth grade on up, is that we're not continuing the journey of explicit instruction. And we have to recognize that many of our kids don't know what to do when they encounter a more complex text. And explicit instruction in multisyllabic decoding, morphology, have got to continue. When I speak with teachers who teach fourth, fifth, middle school, high school, and I say, do your kids know what to do when they encounter complex words? And by the way, our students have an avalanche of complex words, you know, as David Scherer says, from third grade on up, especially in the content areas. And we just expect them to be able to read it. And many of them stop or skip or guess. And so, you know, many of our teachers who work with our students in these grades, they nod, yes, we don't know what to do. So, you know, us at 95% Group in our toolkit, you know, our tier one phonics and word study program goes up to fourth and fifth grade. And we focus on multisyllabic decoding. We focus on morphology. You know, we have a program called Morpheme Magic that we use up through high school. And our middle school and high school teachers, you know, we need to help them understand how to help kids know what to do when they encounter those big words. So that's another shift I think we all have to reconcile with, is that we continue to learn how to read. And in the early grades, even when we're learning those early basic skills, we're reading to learn. You know, reading is meaningful and should be meaningful, even in the early grades.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, there was so much great content that was just packed into that answer. It's going to be impossible to, you know, sort of pull strings on all of it. But, you know, to contextualize what you just said, even when students get to the grade levels that I work with in college, they are still learning how to read text. So, you know, like one of the transition points that, you know, I can point to in my experience is when students reach certain classes where they start to read academic journal articles rather than textbooks. That is a big jump, because all of a sudden they are encountering, in many cases, you know, language that is part of a system of research methodology that they've not really been exposed to before, or they're encountering terms that are very specific and nuanced, associated with theories that guide those research studies. And you know, frankly, I mean, even faculty members have to decode that in many respects, let alone sophomores and juniors in a college classroom. And so, you know, the point that you make is really good, that it is a lifelong growth process. As you get more specific into a field, being able to decode the language systems within that field is critically important.
That's right. And those of us who teach, you know, we have to know how to teach that. Yeah. Regardless, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that you mentioned that I want to go back to, and for personal reasons, my daughter's a middle school teacher and she confronts this. She teaches social studies. That all teachers are reading teachers. And I think that's so important, because I mentioned in the intro to the podcast that I slipped this phrase in, but it's a compounding problem. And if students are lower in literacy, you know, you've probably seen this in your experiences, how that has cascading impacts on their ability to learn math, their ability to learn science, everything.
Yeah, for sure. And I would say that, yeah, and it is a compounding problem. And I, you know, there are so many statistics, Scott, around, you know, our students who, you know, if they have low literacy in third grade, you know, how it's connected to high school dropout. If they low literacy in middle school, connected to, you know, juvenile you know, issues in the juvenile system and the juvenile system connected to the prison system, on and on and on. And I could pull those statistics, but I think we all can, you know, can understand what they are. And so the downward spiral and the connection from literacy to grim outcomes is real. You know, I listened to a gentleman named Hildegard Pelzer, and he has spent his career really working with troubled youth and youth in prisons. And he said the common denominator is they were struggling readers.
Yeah.
And this it is not hyperbole, Scott, to say that this is a life and death situation, literacy. Yeah. And so that we have got to take this seriously. And it's interesting, you mentioned your daughter. You know, first of all, thank you to your daughter for being in the profession and for being a middle school teacher. Thank you. I just honor teachers in all my work, and I'm very grateful for young people that go into the teaching profession. So thank her. And I, you know, years ago, not that long ago, I would hear from middle school and high school teachers who would say, well, that's not my job to teach reading. You know, I expect them to come to me reading. And I actually started my career in middle school, middle school English, and it was heartbreaking to me, which is part of what started me on this, on my mission. It was heartbreaking to me that I had students who could not be availed to the beauty of what I considered, you know, the literature that I wanted them to have the connection to, you know, that I was fortunate to lead, you know, this literate life and to have this, you know, the beauty of leading this literate life. And I wanted them to have that too. And it was heartbreaking to me that they didn't. And so not knowing how to help them, you know, I wasn't taught how to teach reading. It's important that we know that. And, but now, you know, again, just not that long ago, I had teachers telling me, well, it's not my job. You know, I don't know. I have a lot of middle school and even high school teachers coming to sessions that in which I'm, you know, talking about beginning literacy and teaching students how to read, because they want to know. They're like, I don't know what to do, you know, and I need to know. Okay. So when leaders, and part of this, you know, this book that I wrote called Courage to Lead Literacy, you know, is about when I say to leaders, you have got to lead the charge for literacy in your schools and your districts. And part of that is recognizing that all of your teachers need to know this. Until all of your students are readers, all of your teachers need to know this. Yeah.
So I think that, you know, the idea of understanding how to integrate the science of reading resources into classrooms, I think people get that and they understand. I think, you know, because of all the things that we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes or so, they understand why that's so important. But it's hard. You know, in order to do that effectively, you have to align a lot of different things. You have to align how you're training the teachers initially. You have to align how you're integrating science of reading into domains of knowledge in different subject areas. You know, the example that you used of yourself or with my daughter, how does it integrate into English? How does it integrate into social studies, into math? You also have to align how you're assessing with students, and then the assessment feedback loop. And so that alignment, in order for this to be an effective intervention nationally, internationally, that alignment has to be, you know, carefully thought out. How do you sort of, you know, talk through that big problem of getting all the resources aligned and maybe use this as an opportunity to start leaning into, you know, the perspective that the 50% group takes and the products that you create?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just want to say, you know, again, I acknowledge teachers in, you know, making shifts in their own teaching and thinking about how do they integrate, you know, some of the principles that I guess would fall into the science of reading, principles of practice, into their own teaching. Because I think, you know, instruction that if they're moving away from some of their past practices into current practices, it can be a challenge. You know, for example, I know that in many subject areas, content areas, especially for example, middle school teachers, we're used to You know, providing models for students, giving students some examples, then turning students loose for practicing on their own. You know, that's kind of a classic lesson. But explicit instruction requires us to be very clear in our lesson design. You know, I do, we do, you do approach, you know, with clear, concise teacher talk, guided practice, monitored practice with feedback. And when you talk about alignment, you know, it's really important that we have consistent use of academic language. I think alignment across grades and across an entire district is really important. You know, kids thrive with consistent lesson design, consistent routines. I think it's a misunderstanding that we have to provide kids with a lot of variety and a lot of novelty and a lot of new activities all the time. You know, when students know what to expect, when they know what to do, when they know the process, they can focus their cognitive energy on the learning. So I believe that structure is very liberating for students. And so across core and intervention, you know, having similar lesson design, similar instructional language, similar academic language, similar routines, high-impact routines, all that is really important. So that alignment, I think, is critical. Another thing that I think we have to think about in alignment is, and this is hard for many of us as teachers, less teacher talk and more student practice. You know, I was at the International Dyslexia Conference this year, and one of the speakers, actually several of the speakers, addressed how little practice we actually have students do, how little reading and writing we actually have students do in the ELA block. And so making sure that our ELA block includes robust student application, that we have our students do, you know, reading and writing, that they're applying the skills that they're learning. And so less teacher talk, more student practice. So there are certain principles, I think, that really align with evidence that we have to think about as we consider making shifts in our practice. The other thing I think that sometimes teachers, and when they think about shifts in their practice, I'm trying to acknowledge as teachers some of the challenges they face. Sometimes I believe that teachers think as they shift into more explicit instruction that they have to teach a program with fidelity, and that idea of fidelity means they have to follow a program, you know, as written, and maybe it's a scripted program and they have to follow the script. And I actually don't like the word fidelity. I like to use the word integrity. And following a program with integrity means, first of all, that you choose a resource, an instructional resource, that is evidence aligned. In other words, it follows the principles of evidence that we know by evidence aligned, I mean, follows the science of reading principles. And it also has evidence-based, in other words, efficacy, shows that the program works, the resources work with real kids and real teachers and real classrooms. So you use a good program. And using it with integrity simply means that you follow the program, but the first response is to the students, right? Mm-hmm. The first response is not to the program itself, right? A good resource is designed to serve instruction, and instruction is designed to serve the student. Right. So I like to say follow the program with integrity. Now, with that being said, I believe instructional dialogue, a consistent instructional dialogue, is important. I'll give you an example. You know, I was talking about this very thing, having good instructional dialogue, and how from classroom to classroom, across a school, making sure we're using the same language is really critical. And a first grade teacher said to me, she goes, "That is an aha moment for me." She said, "I teach first grade and I have a student," and she said, "it suddenly occurred to me that in our classroom, we call this pattern, we teach this pattern, long vowel, silent E. But in the intervention setting, they call it magic E." Mm. My first grader doesn't know it's the same thing. So just that's a simple example, but you get it. Like it's having the same academic language and having the same routines are really important for kids. So I would say I just want to acknowledge that the challenge in alignment sometimes is very real, and that alignment is critical. I would say that in terms of other alignment that you alluded to, in the assessment, et cetera, I do want to give a shout out to 95% Group because, you know, we provide our educators with a system that aligns data and instruction and materials and support. It's called our 95 Literacy Intervention System, and I love the word system. Because system really describes what we're trying to construct in an educational environment. We need a system, because a system implies a working environment in which all the pieces are interrelated and work together. And so our 95 Literacy Intervention System, you know, teachers, first of all, it's a digital platform, and teachers utilize our assessments to diagnose phonemic awareness and phonic skill deficits. And from those assessments, the system offers grouping students, it can group students. And then it can help the teacher deliver precise intervention instruction connected exactly to our lessons in our resources. So imagine how precise and how helpful that is for a teacher to not have to, you know, take that assessment data and then manually, you know, have to analyze the data and put the students into groups. Now, with that being said, the grouping in the system also allows for a teacher to make adjustments as needed. Right. So it's also is responsive for teacher input. The system also provides ongoing progress monitoring. So it's a whole system of, assessment, grouping, pinpointed instruction connected to lessons. Right. So it's a wonderful kind of, interrelated system of assessment and instruction. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I think is really critical about a system is the data is visible to all stakeholders. So everyone can see that student level progress. So not only can all teachers who touch that student see the data, but at the school level, that data can drive school level actions. So for example, if the school is using a walk to intervention model, that student level data can help with that walk to intervention grouping. And also that student level data can help drive district level actions. So at the district level, that data can help make decisions around professional learning initiatives or resource initiatives. So, assessments drive instruction, drive lessons and instructional materials, and data visibility. All that's included in our 95 Literacy Intervention System.
So first, let me say, I love the way that you characterize fidelity and integrity. Mm-hmm. I'm going to steal that later this afternoon. In fact, I love that. I think that's an important way to characterize it, really any type of intervention. I mean, you're trying to act with integrity to accomplish the goals that you're trying to accomplish, mm-hmm. Recognizing that you still have 20, 25, 30 students sitting out in front of you that you have to connect with first. I just love the way that you characterize that. This issue of data, I think, is so interesting because in your experiences, you were just talking about the fact that at the school level or even at the district level, you can use data to make decisions. Mm-hmm. Have you seen, dramatic differences from, say one school to another, one district to another, where that was hidden in terms of what the nuance was because they didn't have that data, and then how that transformed the way that they would approach it because all of a sudden it became visible?
Oh, 100%. I've had the privilege of working with many, what I call courageous leaders. And they're ones who have said, okay, we are no longer going to hide the data. And they're ones who have had, for example, data rooms where they gather you know, all the teachers into a room and they look at all the data of all the students and they say, these are our students, right? This isn't, you know, Miss Stewart students and Mr. Distill students. These are all of our students. How are all of our students doing? And we're going to look at this every week and we're going to see how our students are doing and who's moving, who's not moving, why are they not moving, how are we going to put our kids in groups, how are we going to cross grade group, how are we going to do a walk to intervention within our whole school, how are we going to mobilize every adult human in this school to take a small group during our walk to intervention time so that every student is getting what they need during that time so we can move our entire school, you know, during this time. You know, having that kind of courage to really examine the data is a bold move that allows us to deliver on the promise of all means all. And, you know, I'll never forget this. This was probably 4 years ago. I was at a conference in Montana, and a superintendent, you know, stood up and he said, I realized that we had all kinds of platitudes around our schools, around our in our district, and they said things like, you know, we believe all students can learn, and you know, everybody's a learner. He said, but I, you know, kind of woke up in a cold sweat, and I said, do we really? Do we really believe that? And he said, I, you know, when I look at the data, we looked okay on average, but we had a significant number of students who were falling through the cracks. Mm-hmm. It's just that we had enough students who were above the, you know, above there that we were bringing up the average.
Yeah.
And he said, that's not okay. And so really to really believe and live the promise of all means all, we've got to be honest. And one of the, you know, and I think that's what it really means. It really means looking at all the data for all the students all the time and being honest about that and then taking action based on that and not backing away from it. One of the things that I've done when we've had these Science of Reading symposia, 95% Group has sponsored these symposia for leaders. And one of the activities that I've had our leaders do is get into small groups and, you know, chart the hard questions, you know, that we need to ask ourselves. And I call it bold questions, bold moves, right? And what are the kinds of bold questions we have to ask ourselves as leaders? And you know, a lot of really interesting conversations come from those bold questions. And you know, many of the questions are around that. You know, have we taken an honest look at the data? Or sometimes, you know, they will ask themselves, what do we really believe about children and learning? Do we really believe that 95% or more of our students can learn to read? And if we do believe that, and that is the truth, you know, statistically, reading is a learned skill, why are we living in the gap? Why are we accepting the gap? Do we have the will and the skill? confronting our own biases and beliefs is a huge part of being able to move the needle. And that's kind of many times the unspoken part of it. And it's easier, I think, sometimes for a leader of a school district or leaders of a school district to go in front of their school board and say, oh, we're doing fine, than it is to say, you know what, we have a problem. We've got these kids and who are chronically not, we're graduating these kids, or these kids are not graduating, who are going out into the world, into our community, and they have low levels of literacy, or they're not learning to read, and we've got to do something about it. That's bold leadership, right? And yeah, it all starts with looking at the data early on. You know, we cannot continue to have our kids, you know, struggling on and on and on. We just can't do it.
The way that you characterize that is so smart. It is easy to hide things in an average. And, you know, and if you're really committed to helping students achieve at a high level, you're paying a lot of attention to students all throughout that spectrum of where they're at in that bell curve. You know, you want to be able to push the students that are at the high end so that they achieve at even higher levels and not have them remain stagnant. You want to be able to help the students that are at the low end of that bell curve bring their scores up so that they can, you know, achieve the benefits of, you know, having a literate perspective on life. And I think that's so important. And if you're just looking at, if you're looking at static data in raw averages, a lot of that gets concealed.
And I think we know so much more now, Scott, than we ever did, around what, you know, what happens when things go wrong, you know, when students don't learn how to read early on, and what to do about it. We know so much, and we have got to, we've got to pay attention, and we've got to take action. And you also mentioned those students who, you know, who, for whom learning to read is seemingly effortless. There are those students. Let's not forget that. And, you know, I recently finished a book called The Science of Reading 3.0. And I call it 3.0 because I had written a book called Science of Reading 2.0. And this was all about, you know, taking knowledge and trying to put it into practice, right? What's the next step? After building a knowledge base, the next step is putting it into practice. And The Science of Reading 3.0 is about how do we widen the lens on literacy, and how do we really pay attention to some of those areas of literacy that we have not paid attention to in the past. And I have 18 amazing literacy, you know, renowned literacy experts contributing to that book, and I'm so honored by their contributions. And, you know, we address certain issues that around differentiation. And one of the, you know, one of the experts that I have asked to contribute is a gentleman named Amir Baraka, and he's a gentleman who, you know, struggled with being a learner with dyslexia, and so he talks about, you know, how we have got to early on, you know, look at our students who struggle, and so that's kind of addressing that issue, right? Like the students who struggle. But then I had Nancy Young, who talks about, you know, students who seemingly, you know, for whom reading is seemingly effortless, you know, those advanced early readers. And how do we then meet the needs of all of our diverse learners? And the good news is we know a lot about how to address all their needs. And that's really part of what the Science of Reading 3.0 is about. Really, you know, we have this knowledge base, right? That's Science of Reading 1.0. We are putting it into practice. That's 2.0. 3.0 is really expanding and widening that lens now. How do we be more precise, and how do we be more responsive, and how do we be more acknowledging in our understanding, so that we can meet the needs of all of our learners, and go back to what you and I first started talking about, is really moving that needle. And like I said, you know, we've got to stay the course, and we have more work to be done, you know, because we still haven't gotten there yet. It's not a matter of just knowing the science of reading, right? We still have a lot of more work to be done before we can really make a difference for all of our students.
Lori, I've got just two questions left. You've talked in very specific terms about the need for consistency, the need to have a common academic language, the need to have integrity in the way that teachers are implementing systems to try to help students. That implies, on one hand, that there is a, you know, a consistent way that teachers approach the classroom. At the same time, we also have been, just in the last few minutes, talking about the fact that students are at very different levels on that spectrum in any given classroom, mm-hmm. let alone school, let alone district. So two things can be true. One is that you have that consistency, but at the same time, you also have to have a recognition that students are starting at different places. So when you put that into the language of science of reading and the 95% group's ecosystem of resources, you have different tiers of instruction and intervention that teachers are doing. Can you kind of talk about how, as you move from tier one to tier two to tier three, both how there is consistency across those different levels of intervention, at the same time recognizing that students in those different buckets, if you will, of intervention are having to receive very different emphasis of resources to help them progress.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for allowing me to talk about 95% Group, because I really love that opportunity. So, well, first of all, I'd say, you know, we have a very interesting history. 95% Group started out as a consulting organization because our founder, Susan Hall, really started down this path as a mother trying to solve a problem. She had a son who was not learning how to read, so she educated herself on what she needed to learn to get him the help he needed. He was an undiagnosed student with dyslexia, so she educated herself on what you know, he needed, and she learned that teachers just didn't know, you know, what to do in all this. And so she started this company really to help teachers learn this information. And so she and her small band of consultants moved around the country training teachers. And as they trained and coached teachers, they were asked by, you know, their clients to develop materials that teachers could use with their students in intervention. And so the array of resources that were developed initially were all intervention. And the flagship program that was developed at that time was the Phonics Lesson Library, which is still, you know, used on a widespread basis around the country. It's very effective. We have a lot of great efficacy studies that show that program really works. And I will say that's one thing I'm really proud of at 95% Group. And one of the reasons that I joined is because 95% Group is probably one of the only companies that invests in high-quality efficacy studies, third-party efficacy studies, because Susan Hall and even today, we don't want to just put stuff out there in the world. Like, we want to put stuff out in the world that we know works. So we really invest in that. So those programs, those intervention programs, were really successful. And when the COVID shutdown occurred, the company pivoted and developed Tier 1 core programs, specifically the phonics core program. And as I mentioned, you know, our phonics core program is one of the only foundational Tier 1 programs that goes all the way up through fifth grade, because we know that word study doesn't end. Phonics and word study don't end at third grade, right? They go on into multisyllabic decoding, morphology, etc. So I would say that the materials that we've developed over the years are developed to fill a void in the market and support the research-based practices. And, you know, they support instruction that is delivered by a skilled teacher. And so one of our, I forgot to mention this earlier when I was talking about our ecosystem, you know, we provide professional learning. That's a core of our business. That was the origination of our business. You know, we provide virtual training, we provide embedded professional learning videos in our ecosystem, we provide, you know, professional learning and variety of access points. Our expert coaching is really, I think, our crown jewel. You know, we go into classrooms, we provide coaching for teachers. That's really the key, I think, to long-term sustainable change, is in classroom support. That's really what we do really best. So our coaching is really key. So when I came on to 95% Group, you know, my questions really centered around, you know, our ecosystem, like, where do we want to go from here? And, you know, what are the attributes that really define our ecosystem? We want to be evidence aligned. Like, we want to look at that preponderance of evidence and make sure that our programs, that our resources are evidence aligned. We want to be evidence based. You know, we want to make sure that we're investing in that high quality third party research. We want to have an alignment in lesson design, as I mentioned. Those that I do, we do, you do approach, those similar routines, that similar academic language. So all of those things became a good litmus test as far as our development and our acquisitions. So when I think about our kind of, you know, ecosystem of supplemental programs that make up an ecosystem of ELA programs, all of those programs really fit together in terms of those attributes. And they all have really solid professional learning to support them, because we know that that's critical, because, again, in the hands of a skilled teacher, good instruction materials are golden, and our teachers deserve to have good instructional resources, good tools in their hands. We don't expect teachers to just make stuff up as they go along. And so we want to put good tools in their hands. And we know that good tools in the hands of a skilled teacher can really deliver on that promise. So we have all kinds of wonderful resources, tier one, tier two, tier three, that all align in those criteria. And with the excellence that I think we have in the supplemental literacy market, I'm just really proud and excited about what we have to offer.
The last question that I have, you, in your career, you've been involved in, you know, national level discussions and advocacy related to this. And as we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, many states, over 40 now, including my mm-hmm. home state of Ohio,
yes.
Has adopted legislation, mm-hmm. you know, that mandates the use of science of reading materials. And as you said, some of these legislative attempts have been more specific than others. Some are somewhat vague in the way that they talk about that. But that legislative action, you know, sort of sets a stage that is starting to require everyone in the field to start having this conversation. Because of your background in this national level advocacy, what do you think comes after that? So we've gotten the attention of legislators, mm-hmm. and they've you know, sort of lit the fire.
Yeah.
That's not going to be enough, nor do we want, you know, legislators to, you know, be designing instructional materials. But
right.
what is yeah. the next step of, you know, really progressing this mm-hmm. national movement to help more students succeed?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I wish I had a crystal ball, Scott, and I could tell yeah. you exactly the answer. I will say that, you know, I think Governor DeWine mm-hmm. was very bold in what he did, because what he did is he said, look, one of the levers that we have to pull, and I think there's many levers, is one of the levers we have to pull is high quality evidence aligned instructional resources. And what we put in teachers' hands really matters. And so let's narrow down what we're going to put in teachers' hands. Let's not have anything and everything. You know, I do think, you know, from firsthand, from working with teachers all over the country for decades, that, you know, it's really important that what we put in teachers' hands really matters. And that is kind of an atypical move. You know, we have valued autonomy for many, many years. And I think that, you know, giving teachers anything and everything, to be honest, can also be disempowering. So I do think giving teachers good materials can be very, very empowering. So I applaud a move like that. That's one lever. I would say that when we take lessons from places like Mississippi, and make no mistake, it's not a Mississippi miracle, it's a Mississippi marathon, as you know, many of the people who've worked in Mississippi have told me, you know, Kimiana Burke is one person that I've interviewed before, and she says it's not a miracle, it's a marathon. You can't take your foot off the gas, right? Like you, mm-hmm. we never arrive. Like we never get to the point where you go, we're done, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's a marathon. But one of the things that they learned is that it isn't one thing; it's multiple levers that need to be pulled. It's teacher training to begin with, so it's higher education. It's ongoing teacher support and development, because the science evolves. The science isn't static. The evidence isn't static. So we have to have ongoing teacher support and development. And the teacher profession is a continual churn, right? We have new teachers all the time. It is, you know, some legislation, but again, the legislation has to be of high quality, and it has to be, there has to be some teeth behind it. It can't just be a nod, just a head nod. There has to be something behind it. It has to be community involvement, has to be, you know, parent involvement. A person that, you know, is doing a lot in terms of parent advocacy is a person named Brett Tingley. She has an organization called Parents for Reading Justice, and it's a way for parents, she's provided a blueprint for ways for parents to get involved. She's right there in your fine state, a way for parents to get involved. It has to be so teachers, parents, communities. I think one of our greatest untapped resources is helping our school boards understand how they can support making sure that the graduates in their communities are literate citizens, ready for school workforce service. I think that we also have to ensure that we have the right resources. So there's multiple levers that have to be pulled. Mm-hmm. You know, Excel and Ed is a wonderful resource. People can check out that website to look at kind of the toolkit of places where we can go to look at those levers and think about, okay, what do we need to put together to make sure that all of these things are in place. So there is no, I don't think there's one answer that we need to do. We just need to look at a comprehensive approach. And frankly, it all starts at the local level. What are we doing at the local level at a comprehensive approach to ensure that at a local level, we are accomplishing our goals for literacy? And then what are we doing at a state level to accomplish our goals for literacy? So we have to start at each of those levels. It's like it's like the Russian doll, right? Like how are we making sure that at each level we're accomplishing those goals, we're pulling those levers, and we're learning lessons from places where we are having success. You know, like I look at, when I look at our portfolio of research, we have a robust portfolio of research that people can access on our website. We have a lot of success stories of local levels where they're using our products, for example, and our practices and our professional learning and getting great success. You know, we could start there, look at some of those school districts and look at them as case studies and as places where people are getting success. What are they doing, right? What lessons have they learned? And I think we can start there and build from that, from those local successes. So I think there's resources out there to help us build that, but I think we have to act in unison and in collaboration and in a comprehensive approach to get it done. But I'm not giving up, and and I think you're not giving up. A lot of us aren't giving up. There's work to be done, as we said at the very beginning.
Yeah, as you've noted, it's a conversation that can't take place at one level. It has to take place at all levels. And I think the more that we have dialogues like this, the more opportunities there are for others to enter into that conversation. Ultimately, that's what's important.
Go ahead. I was going to say thank you for your podcast, because I think that's one place that the forum for people to listen. I mean, I listen to your podcast, and every time I do, I learn something. And I think this is another place where people can listen and learn and enrich themselves and pass that on so that more of us can learn and keep growing and keep talking and keep solving problems together.
Absolutely. Laura, it's been great getting to know you. And I just want to thank you for, you know, the leadership and the wisdom, that you've provided in this hour. But really through your entire career and trying to advance helping students. I mean, ultimately, that's why so many of us got into what it is that we're doing, whatever facet is that we're doing in education. You've really dedicated a lot of what you do over your career to helping students in this one area that is understandably one of the most important things for children to develop skills in. I think about my own background, and I was one of those undiagnosed dyslexics that you mentioned, and being able to sort of work through that and become somebody that reads avidly is, you know, really the reason why I'm sitting in this chair right now. So important, and thank you for the leadership you've been providing. Continue to do so.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
Absolutely. My guest today has been Laura Stewart. She's the Chief Academic Officer of the 95% Group. If you are interested in learning more about the topics we've been discussing, we will have the link to the 95% Group website and the text accompanying the podcast. Many of the resources that Laura was talking about, you can find on that website, in addition to learning about the products that they have available for districts and schools to consider. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Thank you to Trinity Sweet and April Koska, the associate producers, for the work they do behind the scenes. If you have ideas, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to reach out via email. All you need to do is send an email to Teaching Matters Podcast, all one word, all lowercase, teachingmatterspodcast@ohio.edu. We look forward to seeing you in the next episode. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.